Hey everyone, welcome back and thank you for being here. So we are going to continue on with Jean-Luc Nancy's Of Divine Places. And before that, we're going to start off with another poem by Louise Gluck and another poem by Richard Sidekin, one each. This one by Louise Gluck is called The Setting Sun from Winter Recipes. From the collective. Winter Recipes itself is a really lovely poem. One of the lines is, we're gonna, I think we'll do it in the next episode. So I won't cover too much from it. The Setting Sun. One, I'm glad you like it, he said, since it may be the last of its kind. There was nothing to say. In fact, it did seem the end of something. It was a solemn moment. We stood a while in silence, staring at it together. Outside, the sun was setting, the sort of pointed symmetry I have always noticed. If only I'd known, he said, the effect of words. Do you see how this thing has acquired weight and importance since I spoke? I could have done this long ago, he said, and not wasted my time beginning over and over. Two. My teacher was holding a brush, but then I was holding a brush too. We were standing together watching the canvas, out of the corners of which a turbulent darkness surged. In the center was ostensibly a portrait of a dog. The dog had a kind of forced quality. I could see that now. I have never been much good with living things. Brightness and darkness I do rather well with. I was very young. Many things had happened, but nothing had happened repeatedly, which makes a difference. I think, yeah. I forgot to do the thing again. Was over the shoulder? No. It's background? No. Okay. My teacher, who had spoken not a word, began to turn now to the other students. Sorry as I felt for myself at that moment, I felt sorrier for my teacher, who always wore the same clothes and had no life, or no apparent life, only a keen sense of what was alive on canvas. With my free hand, I touched his shoulder. Why, sir, I asked, have you no comment on the work before us? I have been blind for many years, he said. Though when I could see, I had a subtle and discerning eye, of which I believe there is ample evidence in my own work. This is why I give you assignments, he said, and why I question all of you so scrupulously. As to my current predicament, when I judge from a student's despair and anger he has become an artist, then I speak. Tell me, he added, what do you think of your own work? Not enough night, I answered. In the night, I can see my own soul. That is also my vision, he said. Three. I'm against symmetry, he said. He was holding in both hands an unbalanced piece of wood that had been very large once, like the limb of a tree. This was before its second life in the water, after which, though there was less of it in terms of mass, there was greater spiritual density. Driftwood, he said, confirms my view. This is why it seems inherently dramatic. To make this point, he tapped the wood. Rather violently, it seemed, because a piece broke off. Movement, he cried. That is the lesson. Look at these paintings, he said, meaning ours. I have been making art longer than you've been breathing, and yet my canvases have life. They are drowning in life. Here he grew silent. I stood beside my work, which now seemed rigid and lifeless. We will take our break now, he said. I stepped outside for a moment into the night air. It was a cold night. The town was on a beach near where the wood had been. I felt I had no future at all. I had tried and I had failed. I had mistaken my failures for triumphs. The phrase smoke and mirrors entered my head. And suddenly, my teacher was standing beside me. smoking a cigarette. He had been smoking for many years. His skin was full of wrinkles. "You were right," he said, "the way instinctively you stepped aside. Not many do that, you'll notice." "The work will come," he said. "The lines will emerge from the brush." He paused here to gaze calmly at the sea in which now all the planets were reflected. "The driftwood is just a show," he said. "It entertains the children." "Still," he said, "it is rather beautiful, I think, like those misshapen trees the Chinese grow. Punzai, they're called." And he handed me the piece of driftwood that had broken off. "Start small," he said, and patted my shoulder. "Four. Try to think," said the teacher, "of an image from your childhood." "Spoon," said one boy. "Ah," said the teacher, "this is not an image." "It is," said the boy. "See, I hold it in my hand, and on the convex side, a room appears, but distorted, the middle taking longer to see than the two ends." "Yes," said the teacher, "that is so. But in the larger sense, it is not so. If you move your hand even an inch, it is not so." "You weren't there," said the boy. "You don't know how he set the table." "That is true," said the teacher. "I know nothing of your childhood. But if you add your mother to the distorted furniture, you will have an image." "Will it be good?" said the boy. "A strong image?" "Very strong," said the teacher. "Very strong and full of foreboding." Saying Your Name is by Richard Sykin from Crush, hosted on fishhousepoems.org/sayingyournames. Chemical names, bird names of fire and flight and snow, baby names, paint names, delicate names like bones in the body. What I'll say is this seems to be an ode to the multiplicity and diversity of being and God and naming. And that's why I'm presenting it in relation to. Do they have all of them on here? Nice. This is a pretty good one. I haven't read the other book. Poets. What do you have by him? Saying Your Name, Scheherazade, Road Music. I like road music. Anyway, it's kind of, I think Luke calls Sagan's writing obsessive. She was the judge, like I said, for the book that this was published in that won the award. And yeah, so we're just gonna read this. But hopefully that helps you kind of frame what we read and what he's talking about with these different, with chemical names, bird names, names of fire and flight and snow. What does that mean, right? Saying Your Name is Richard Sagan. Chemical names, bird names of fire and flight and snow, baby names, paint names, delicate names like bones in the body, Rumpelstiltskin names that are always changing, names that no one's ever able to figure out, names of spells and names of hexes, names cursed quietly under the breath or called out loudly to fill the yard, calling you inside again, calling you home. Nicknames and pet names and Baroque French monikers, written in shorthand, written in longhand, scrawled illegibly in brown ink. On the backs of yellowing photographs are embossed on envelopes lined with gold. Names called out across the water. Names I called you behind your back, sour and delicious, secret and unrepeatable. The names of flowers that open only once, shouted from balconies, shouted from rooftops, or muffled by pillows, or whispered in sleep, or caught in the throat like a lump of meat. I try, I do. I try and try. A happy ending? Sure enough. Hello, darling. Welcome home. I call you darling, hold you tight. We are not traitors, but the lights go out. It's dark. Sweetheart, is that you? There are no tears, no pictures of him squarely. A seaside framed in glass and boats, those little boats with sails aflutter, shining lights upon the water, lights that splinter when they hit the pier. His voice on tape, his name on the envelope. The soft sound of a body falling off a bridge behind you. The body hardly even makes a sound. The waters of the dead, a clear road. Every lover in the form of stars, the road blocked. All night I stretched my arms across him, rivers of blood, the dark woods, singing with all my skin and bone. Please keep him safe. Let him lay his head on my chest, and we will be like sailors swimming in the sound of it, dashed to pieces. Makes a cathedral. Him pressing against me, his lips at my neck, and yes, I do believe his mouth is heaven, his kisses falling over me like stars. I think we can think that immediacy, because the end of this poem talks about, or I think it's the end of, there's a lot left to it. But I think, the kissing and the lips smacking, and all the like sexuality, I guess we'd say, of Sykin's writing is a place where we have religious experience, where we experience the divine. And it's part and parcel with the immediacy of the nature of being, the mitzvah. Snow and Dirty Rain. That's the poem that it's in. And we'll do that in the next episode. So, makes a cathedral, him pressing against me, his lips at my neck. And yes, I do believe his mouth is heaven, his kisses falling over me like stars. Names of heat and names of light, names of collision in the dark on the side of the bus, in the bark of the tree, in ballpoint pen, on jeans and hands, and the backs of matchbooks that then get lost. Names like pain cries, names like tombstones. Names forgotten and reinvented, names forbidden or overused. Your name, like a song I sing to myself, your name, like a box where I keep my love, your name, like a nest in the tree of love, your name, like a boat in the sea of love. Oh, now we're in the sea of love. Your name, like detergent in the washing machine, your name, like two X's, like punched in eyes, like a drunk cartoon passed out in the gutter, your name with two X's to mark the spots, to hold the place. To keep the treasure from ever becoming ever lost. I'm saying your name in the grocery store. I'm saying your name on the bridge at dawn. Your name like an animal covered with frost. Your name like a music that's been transposed. A suit of fur, a coat of mud, a kick in the pants, a lung full of glass, the sails and wind, and the slap of waves on the hull of a boat that's sinking to the sound of mermaids singing songs of love. And the tug of a simple, profound sadness when it sounds so far away. Here is a map with your name for a capital. Here's an arrow to prove a point. We laugh and it pits the world against us. We laugh and we've got nothing left to lose. And our hearts turn red and the river rises like a barn on fire. I came to tell you we'll swim in the water. We'll swim like something sparkling underneath the waves. Our bodies shivering and the sound of our breathing and the shore so far away. I'll use my body like a ladder, climbing to the thing behind it, saying farewell to flesh. Farewell to everything caught underfoot and flattened. Names of poisons. Names of handguns, names of places we've been together, names of people we'd be together, names of endurance, names of devotion, street names and place names, and all the names of the dark of our dark heaven crackling in their pan. It's a bed of straw, darling. It sure as shit is. If there was one thing I could save from the fire, he said, the broken arms of the sycamore, the eucalyptus still trying to climb out of the yard. Your breath on my neck like a music that holds my hands down, kisses as they burn their way along my spine. Or rain, our bodies wet, clothes clean, arm to elbow, clothes clean, nipple to groin. I'll be right here. I'm waiting. Say hallelujah, say goodnight, say it over. the canned music and your feet won't stumble. His face getting larger, the rest blurring on every side. And angels, about 12 angels, angels knocking on your head right now. Hello, hello. A flash in the sky. Would you like to meet him there in heaven? Imagine a room, a sudden glow. Here is my hand, my heart, my throat, my wrist. Here are the illuminated cities at the center of me. And here's the center of me, which is a lake, which is a well that we can drink from. But I can't go through with it. I just don't want to die anymore. Okay. Of Divine Places, section 15. Moreover, this is what grounds such a revelation. The essence of the God is recognizable simultaneously by two features. The first being that man is not the God. Hold on, we'll have to pause this, guys. One second. All right, so she's taking some stuff to the burn pile, so we have a minute. 15 in. So man is not the God. The second that man and the God are together in an identical region of being. Neither of them is being. In Levinas's language, they are together beyond being, but there is no such quote beyond. Heidegger says, the gods and men are not only illumined by a light, they are illumined in their being. They are conquered by light, never hidden, but dislodged. Man and the god and their radical difference, which is none other than the opening out of the sacred, but which is equally well an immediacy outside of the profane and the sacred. Man and the God, in their radical difference, disclose themselves to each other, and perhaps by means of each other. They disclose themselves, they are each for his part and each for the other, those who come disclosed. But what is disclosed here is their strangeness. Where man and the God cease to disclose one another and to be disclosed to each other as strangers, in strangeness itself, there the God disappears. For Hegel, on the contrary, man can know he has a refuge in God since God is not a being strange to him. Perhaps at the extreme, but everything is always decided at the extreme. We will one day have to face the fact, Descouvrir, that the God is essentially distinguishable by nothing save the extreme strangeness of his coming. Euripides writes, quote, numerous are the forms of the divine, and numerous the unexpected decision of the gods. What was expected does not come about, but for the unexpected, the God has found the means. 16. If God is God, his death is also his supreme strangeness. Although Hegel himself cannot ultimately think this death except as the death of death, he nevertheless cannot avoid remaining suspended, seemingly dumbfounded, so that we remark that he too did, after all, experience the divine in the face of the event. The supreme alienation of the divine idea, quote, God is dead, God himself is dead, is a prodigious and dreadful thing to represent to oneself, something which presents to representation the deepest abyss of the deepest abyss of schism. God is no longer alive, God is dead, a most dreadful thought. So everything which is eternal, true, is not. There is negation even in God, supreme suffering, a feeling of out and out perdition. In the death of God, inasmuch as, quote, we have killed him, something of the divine is announced, or rather called upon, as Nietzsche knew it. It is not the death of death, it is not the dialectic of the God of triumphant subjectivity. Of course, the gods are immortal, they all rise again. Osiris, Dionysus, Christ. But resurrection is not what Hegel would like it to be. It is not the end of the process, nor is it the final appropriation of the living concept. Resurrection is the manifestation of the God in as much as he comes in his own withdrawal, leaves his mark in his own obliteration, is revealed in his own invisibility. It is not a resurrection, quote unquote. It is not a return. The God is invisibly manifest and manifestly invisible. This is like a dialectic, but it is not one. It's one of the weirdest things to say. However, the fact that it is not one can only be revealed by the God. Here perhaps lies the difference in knowledge or in experience, that distinguishes Hegel from Hölderlin. What quote unquote resurrection refers to inadequately is the radiance of manifestation. Osiris, Dionysus, Christ are never as radiant. I'll have to pause again, guys. All right, guys. I think it's my stepmom. I think she's done in this area. Took a few minutes. She just cleaned some things up. So let's go back to the bottom of page in the annotated copy, the bottom of page 125, working on the last few paragraphs of section 16. What quote unquote resurrection refers to inadequately is the radiance of manifestation. Osiris, Dionysus, Christ are never as radiant as when they have risen again. They are then what they are, gods of radiance itself, divine glory open. Just making sure Winchester's here. Divine glory open, offered, dazzling as the heavens and effaced like them. But this glory, this splendor, like that of the heavens, emerges from shadow and in shadow, in the darkness of the absence of the heavens, of the absence of the world and of God. Divine radiance is just as much the manifestation of this darkness, which is itself divine. This is not a dialectic. The gods are immortal. Death and resurrection do not apply to them. What does apply to them is what they have in common with the heavens, without the heavens being their mediation. The sovereign interplay of darkness and radiance, of radiance withdrawn into darkness, and of darkness as manifest as radiance. For if mortals have the possibility or the freedom to be unto God, unto what or unto whom can the God be? Unto nothing, unless it be unto divine manifestation itself, radiance, effulgence, and darkness. The God is not the freedom to be unto in general. He is not projected toward or destined to. He simply comes in radiance and in the withdrawal of radiance, or rather, his pure radiance withdraws him. 17. Gia's Ayahud. Quote, the invisible does not conceal itself like an essential secret, like the stone and fruit, at the heart of what we see. Freely displayed for all to see, the hidden always protects the unhidden. I like this quote a lot. It always sticks out to me. It's one of the main ones in this text that sticks out to me. I should like to write, always, whatever happens, a god protects mortals. That is to say, exposes them to what they are. And in so doing, he exposes himself for all to see, withdrawn like the heavens. But that is to write more than I can. Yet Seneca in his time wrote, quote, many beings akin to the supreme being, the supreme divinity, both fill our eyes and escape them. Eyes filled and deserted by divinity. That is our condition. I'll say that again. Eyes filled and deserted by divinity. That is our condition. 18 is really short. 18, origin. If there, and it's like not the or like the origin with an I, or it's spelt with an E at the end. If there is an image of the invisible God, it is an invisible image. 19. So here I think is the introduction where we talk about art for the first time. One might say, there is nothing more divine than a new God shining in all his young splendor. But this new God never comes in any temple. It is the emptiness of the temple and its darkness that makes it that make it the sacred place. Art is sacred not because it is in the service of worship, but because it makes manifest the withdrawal of divine splendor, the invisibility of its manifestation, the inconspicuousness of its exposure. No passage in Hegel better salutes the gods than the one in which fate is shown offering their absence to us. Statues are now corpses whose animating soul has fled. Hymns are words which faith has abandoned. The tables of the gods are without food and spiritual beverage, and games and festivities no longer restore to consciousness the blessed unity between itself and essence. Lacking in the works of the muses is that strength of spirit which saw certainty itself spring forth from the crushing of both gods and men. Henceforth, they are what they are for us, beautiful fruits plucked from the tree. Friendly fate has offered them to us as a young girl presents this fruit. Who is this young girl? She is herself a work of art, She is painted on a fresco. She is deprived of divine life. She is thus a goddess herself, exposed to her own withdrawal. The girl, in the flush of her youth, in the midst of the world of, quote, that pain expressed in the harsh words, God is dead, is the divine truth of the presentation. Hegel writes, presentiart, presentiart, or the offering of this fruit and its beauty. It is a god or a goddess who offers us art. That is something we have still to think about. It is a god or a goddess who offers us art. 20. The sacred in art, thus defined, means that all art is sacred and that there is nothing sacred save in art or through it. Except, like, there's nothing sacred except in art or through it. That is what Christianity and the grip of the Reformation ceased to understand. For its part, the Catholic Church forgot God. This is the craziest stuff. This, it too, ended up losing art. Or thus it too ended up losing art, and so becoming indistinguishable today from the Reformation. There is no profane art, and there is nothing sacred outside of art. However, that is only intelligible if we have done with, quote, aesthetics, and also perhaps with, quote, art. The divine manifests itself at the limits of art, but without art, nothing would reach those limits. And to understand this, ought we not also to have done with the divine? 21. In his study, Divine Names, Usener saw a primary species of gods in those he called the gods of the instant. Divinities attached to nothing other than a momentary state, a sensation, or an isolated feeling. Quote, the singular phenomenon is divinized without mediation, without the intervention of any generic concept, however narrow its limits. The bare thing which you see before you, that and nothing else, is the god. End quote. Usener is certainly wrong to be content with what we might call the positivist and anthropocentric notion of divinization. Positivist meaning what's actually there, what actually exists, what positively exists. Precisely when describing this encounter and this non-conceptual designation of the god, not to be able to place face to face with religious faith anything other than this paltry, artless reversal. The quote, divinization by man of a natural thing is not to be in the death of God. It is to have forgotten the death of God itself. God would not be dead if he had simply been a projection. It's not so, like, the death of God is not to discover that God never existed. The death of God means something else. As Nietzsche well knew, the death of God requires us of us something very different from anthropological idolatry. But Usener does unwittingly furnish the essence of all divine manifestation. The bare thing which you see before you, that and nothing else is the God. The quote, thing can be an animal, a person, a stone, a word, a thought. God is never anything other than a singular bare presence. Quote, God is not present to things by situation, but by essence. His presence manifests itself by its immediate operation. End quote. That's Leibniz, actually. All gods are, quote, gods of the instant for as long as they can or wish to endure. So this is the 22. This is the section. It's only two paragraphs long, pretty short. This is the one that reminded me of Psyche. That's why I included him here. 22. There is the god who ceaselessly plays with the world and the god who fashions it in a perpetual labor. There is the God who comes and offers himself, self-same with the grass or with suffering, and the God who conceals himself in the furthest depths of the temples. There is the God who annihilates man, and the God who dwells in his gaze. There is the God who approaches man to the extent of touching him, and the God who retreats from man to the extent of abandoning him infinitely. The two are the same. The God who touches man touches him so as to leave him to himself, not so as to take a hold of him and detain him. Hence, quote, this is Pascal, quote, the first desertion consists in the fact that God does not detain or force, he gives us free will, as a result of which man leaves him, bringing about the second desertion by which God leaves him. In one of these desertions, God follows, and there is no mystery about it. God deserts us after we desert God, for there is nothing strange in the fact that God leaves the men who leave him. But the first desertion is quite mysterious and incomprehensible that we should leave God. Because we confuse the freedom that he gives us. 23. Judaism is an atheism with God. Yeah, these are crazy. Protestantism, on the other hand, is a theism without God. Catholicism is the worship of all gods in God, or the loss of God in all gods. Islam is the pure proclamation of God to the point where it becomes an empty clamor. Some of these are like shitty things to say, in my opinion. Buddhism is the worship of God in all gods, or the loss of all gods in God. Philosophy, for its part, thinks the communication beyond its confines and the absolute alienation of the infinite substance of God. So, an entire universe for which God will prove to have been the pain and the fervor of infinite separation comes to a close. The vision becoming infinite, imminent in the divine, the death of God inscribed as his life. In a sense, all our great religions are inseparable from philosophy. That is to say, from the ontotheological end, the aim and the cessation of religion. And as for paganism, we're going to pause for a second, guys. All right, so I think he's done with that. I'm kind of slouched right now. Let me make sure I'm in the. Let me sit up. Oh, it's probably better for my posture if I sit up. Better for my back. Don't ever get old, guys. It's a joke because you have to get old. Get it? Like, you don't have to. If you don't get old, it's a bad thing. Try to get old. Do get old. I lied. And as for paganism, where do we grasp it? If not at that extremity, where it already offers in the god the death of the god, Tammuz, Attis, Osiris, Adonis, Dionysus. The death of God is the final thought of philosophy, which thus proposes it as an end to religion. It is toward this thought that the West, which in this case excludes neither Islam nor Buddhism, will have ceaselessly tended. Winchester, come back. Come on, lay down. Boy. Good boy. It signifies the death of death, the negation of negation, the end of the separateness of God, the divinization of man, the making absolute of his knowledge and his history, or the affirmation of their total insignificance. And the infinite suffering that his labor, his discourse, and his death become when they have as their goal and their meaning an infinite reconciliation. The God is abandoned in thought of absolute separation and reconciliation, which is thought of the death of God. The God does not die in that thought, since he rises again there endlessly, like the very being of nothingness that has passed through the nothingness of being. But things are worse. He is abandoned there, or else he abandons us. He abandons us to our philosophy and our religion of the death of God. So thinking about philosophy and God together, obviously. 24. But we must not jump to the conclusion that the quote, God of the philosophers is a vanity pure and simple. Every philosopher in his way, according to the order and the ordeal of thought, also experiences the approach or the flight of the divine. There is at the heart of every great philosophy, and this could be the measure of its greatness, a mystery concerning God or the gods. This is in no way to say that the mystery is the heart of the philosophy that bears it. It certainly is not. But it is placed in that heart, even though it has no place there. Hold on, guys. Okay, I think I was hearing the music was kind of loud. An example, which is also of necessity to say an approximation, quote, in divine understanding, there is a system, but God himself is not a system. He is a life. So here we have some reference to This is before Deleuze writes A Life, Immanence A Life. Nine years before that? Quite interesting. You will always quite justifiably be able to demonstrate the deep-rooted equivalence in speculative idealism of, quote, system and, quote, life. And in so doing, make that statement of Schelling's contradict itself. Yet you will not be able entirely to deny that the same statement tends or pretends to something that is not exhausted by that equivalence and that testifies here to the ordeal of thought. All would seem to hang were one inclined to attempt a commentary upon an exegesis of the words God himself. Schelling is suggesting that the God himself is something other again than, quote, God. From Kant to Hölderlin, by way of Schelling, Novalis, and Hegel, this exigency of thought was put to the test and transmitted to Nietzsche, Rilke, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, Levinas, and us. The God of the philosophers has himself made God, or the gods, his concern. Wild sentences. 25. Though all art is sacred, and though there is doubtless nothing sacred except where there is art, art and the divine are nevertheless two totally distinct things. So this is where you need the wink to where how the invisible presents itself on the face of the visible. Which is to say that when the divine manifests itself, art itself is reduced to nothing. Self same with whatever thing the divine has made manifest, meme, right, on the film of face, at face. For example, a thing of nature, an animal, a stone, or else man himself. This manifestation places the thing within the sphere of art, but at the same time, it reduces art as such to nothing. Ugh. Conversely, art transports what it sets to work upon into the sphere of the divine, because it is always a god or a goddess who offers us art. But of itself, insofar as it is art, or for as long as it is art, it keeps the divine at a distance. In this sense, art is always profane, no less than thought, discourse, or science. Perhaps we are dealing here with two forms of the sublime, different to the extent of being opposites. There is the sublime in art, going from Kant to Benjamin and from there on down to us. It signifies to feel the fainting away of the sensible, to border on the furthest extreme of presentation, on the limit where the outside of presentation offers itself, and to be offered up to this offering. And there is divine sublimity, that in terms of which Hegel seeks to characterize the Jewish moment in religion. In this case, it is the presence of God insofar as it overwhelms the sensible. The coming of God reduces the phenomenon to nothing. Here, the sublime is no longer to be found the furthest extreme of presentation, where presentation is transformed into offering. It is in a presence that ruins all presentation and all representation. It is no longer the gesture of offering, it is the imposition of glory. It is no longer the limit of forms and figures, it is the light that disperses the visible. God himself, his presence outside of all presentation, God imposes his presence outside of all presentation. He comes in the ruin of all appearing. Art, on the contrary, infinitely incises the edges of appearance, but keeps it intact. Between the, quote, thing of sublime art and the sublime, quote, thing of the divine, there can be said to be that infinitesimal and in its turn sublime, quote, question mark, that infinitesimal difference that lies between presentation at the limit and naked presence. It follows that each can offer the other, but also that it is impossible to confuse one with the other. 26. Whoever speaks of gods, of God, risks the detestable effects of the sacralization of discourse. The language that names God is always well on the way to taking on some semblance of his glory. Excuse me, sorry. God, the divine, the sacred, the holy are insuperably sacred words. How could they avoid being a prey to sacerdotal arrogance, ecclesiastical love of power, not to mention clerical cupidity? Alternatively, it is prophetic. It is prophetic bombast that threatens them, not to mention a mystic intensity, whatever their reserve and their sobriety. In each case, discourse appropriates to its own advantage the hierophany behind which it ought to disappear. You must not be blind to the danger today of a certain spiritual posturing, of a particular bland or sublime tone with which a quote sacred dimension is quote rediscovered. It is one of the best signs of the absence of the gods. When the God is there, in fact, his presence is close, familiar, simple, and unobtrusive, even though it be strange, disconcerting, and inaccessible. Parentheses, in Africa, for example, whether conspicuous or concealed from view, the sacred appears familiar. Not that it tips over into profane or profanatory familiarity, but it offers itself or withholds itself with simplicity, and even in laughter and disrespect, because it has no need of a certain solemn seriousness, affected and inspired, which belongs only to churches, states, and speeches. Need I add, the Africa of which I speak is at least in part a symbolic place. 27. The essence of art is to be offered, and it is a god or goddess who offers us art. However, art does not lead to God. Indeed, nothing leads to God, neither art, nor nature, nor thought, nor love. The gods come or do not come. They impose their presence or they withdraw. 28. The god is almost always the immanence, quote, sorry, quote, the god is almost always the immanence of a god or even the mere possibility of a god. That's a lane. To keep open, available, undecided, the possibility for man of a quote being unto God is in itself a most resolute gesture of welcome to the divine. As if this undecidedness alone, our own, were already unto the God. However, it is not by definition, and that is where Elaine is wrong in the end. 29. To have done once and for all with a constantly recurring error. Being is not God in any way. Being is the being of beings, what is, or rather, for it is not part of a being. What it is about a being is the fact that that being is. Consequently, being itself in return is not. The God, on the contrary, is. If he is not, then there is no God. Whereas if being is not, then there is being. Or more accurately, there is equals being. The God, therefore, is a being, and in that respect, he is one being among all other beings. Being is the being of the God, as it is the being of every other being, but the God is not the God of being. That expression would have strictly no meaning. The God is always whatever and wherever he may be, the God of man. Of what sort is this being of God? That is the elusive question. What is God? However, it is at least possible to say this: God is not the supreme being, a taunt. Assuming that there is any sense in talking about a supreme being, God is the being we are not, but which is not a being at our disposal in the world around us either. God is the being we are not, which is not at our disposal either, but which appears or disappears before the face of the existing mortal beings we are. For example, it is only from this angle that we may understand the idea. I'm going to pause for a second, I guess, guys. Never mind. For example, it is only from this angle that we may understand the idea of God as creator. If we wish to avoid lapsing into error, God the Creator is not he who makes being be. Nothing and no one makes beings be. They are not produced, and production exists only within the world of beings. Come on, Winchester. On the other hand, being makes the being of beings. And this is not a making, it is a being. I think this has to do with the relation between to do and to make. Fait lettre. To make and or to do being, right? But where being is something that you're doing or is active. God the creator does not make be, nor does he make the being of beings. God the quote creator, if we can keep this word, means Beings appear before him, emerging from the nothingness of their being. They are summoned and appear before him, who manifests himself or conceals himself before their face in the visible. Fiat lux, make light, does not mean I invent something like light and I make it come into existence by the sole power of my word, as a metaphysical catechism repeatedly asserted. Fiat lux means the light appears before my face and I send myself in it. Hegel, quote, this figure is the pure luminous essence of the dawn, which contains and fills everything, and which is preserved in its formless substantiality, end quote. Nothing can be summoned to appear before being, for being has no face and utters nothing. Being, by not being, delivers beings up to what they are. It is the fact that a being detaches itself from the nothingness it is. Hence, being does not make beings, but it finishes them off. Their finite detachment takes place infinitely in it and from it. That is the finitude of being in all beings. It attaches the gods as well as men. The immortality of the gods does not exclude their finitude. They appear or they disappear, whereas being neither appears nor disappears. It is. So we have a finite immortality. That helps us think about finitude, right? Because it's not related to death necessarily or mortality. It might be related to temporality. Between beings, there can be all sorts of relations. There can be, among others, that of the god to man or that of the man to the god. Beings, on the other hand, have no relation to being, since it is nothing other than the fact that beings are. From this point of view, the god is or is not in the same way as man or a star is. The divine is not the fact that man or the star is. The divine is that or he with which or with whom man finds himself involved in a certain relation, be it one of presence or of absence, one of appearance or of disappearance. He involves the star in it with him. That is why the gods necessarily have places, just like a person, a star, or a bird. Being has no place. It is. It makes the disposition. Hold on. All right, so that wasn't so bad. I probably won't edit the videos or be able to stop them whenever we're using the phone to record. I think they're done now, but it should be fine. Everything should be fine. That is why the gods necessarily have places, just like a person, a star, or a bird. Being has no place. It is. It makes the disposition, the spacing out of beings according to their places. That is to say, also according to their times. But it has itself neither place nor time. It is not. And this not being consists in the fact that beings are disposed throughout their places and their times. The gods have their places and their times. They are immortal and they have a history. The gods have a history and a geography. They can move off, withdraw, spring up, or decline. They can come here or there, now or later, and show themselves. And not show themselves. Thirty. God exists, God does not exist, the proposition God exists, and therefore the opposing proposition too has no meaning. These propositions have not merely been argued back and forth to excess, they have all, and a few more besides, been rigorously proved true. All these proofs and counterproofs put together have perhaps never demonstrated anything other than the fact that being is and is not. For this whole array of proofs was based on a confusion in this discourse between being and God. It was demonstrated that there is necessarily being in God. It was demonstrated that there is necessarily being, or some being, as soon as we admit that there is something. Then it was demonstrated that this there is of being is in itself nothing that is. On the other hand, if in the advancing or the thinking of these proofs there was anything that was at the same time preserved from this confusion, and that truly had to do with the divine as such, it must have been a totally different sort of concern, Susi. Not the concern to show that God, equal necessary being, is, but the concern to intimate that God exists. One, so God's being versus God's existence. One can conceive of the conjunction. One might say the interweaving of these two concerns in the writings of Descartes and also in those of Hegel and Nietzsche. To intimate that God exists, that is to say that he cannot precisely be according to the mode of what we know and grasp as positions of being, and that his is a quite different existence, a quite different ordeal of existing. On this subject, proofs and counterproofs have doubtless always concurred. The proof of the existence of God corresponds to the ordeal of his immediacy, hence the idea of the infinite in me, an idea already present and yet by which I am myself overwhelmed. And that was Descartes' argument for the existence of God. And the critique of this proof again corresponds in its turn to this experience of being overwhelmed. It says, for example, God is not an object of possible experience, so leaving impossible experience open. We thus need to ask some quite different questions, not whether God exists, let's see, but how or else where and when he exists, which is equally to say how he withdraws from existence, how he is not where we expect him to be, how he does not duplicate in another world mode of existence on our own, but is in ours the existence of that other world, or else how his existence is strictly inseparable from that of the world, an animal, or a star, a person, or a poem, and how it unceasingly remains beyond the reach of all of these existences, and so forth. Thirty-one. I'm not going to read the Latin here. This should be our last one. We might be interrupted here in a second. I can't tell yet. No, I don't think so. What is there to say about 31? What is there to say about vanished rites, lost sacred languages, about the necessary incomprehensibility of those languages, which brought with them at the same time a familiar truth? What is there to say about the solemn rhythms of Latin, about genuflections, incense, versicles, and responses, about the church, that remote place full of darkness and splendor? What is there to say about signs of the cross, clasped hands, open palms, outstretched arms, chasubles on shoulders, stoles, shoes left at entrances, ablutions, prayer mats, prostration or intoning? What is there to say about divine service? Nothing. Nothing must be said about them. It is too late or too soon. Wherever divine service takes place, we cannot be sure that it is not merely the pious and ridiculous repetition of what it once was, or else that it is not confined to being the exercising of a social convention, not to say a social obligation. Yet, after all, has it ever been any different? Where and when can we say that true worship takes place? We can say it when the God is present at the ceremony. But in that case, we are not far from saying that the presence of the God in the heart, for example, replaces to advantage the mimicry of worship. And that is not what is called for by our requirement of the divine, our thought of it, our feeling for it. We feel that there must be worship, divine service. We feel that there must be celebration of the glory of the God. And yet, we can say nothing about worship. We can say there are men and women who observe rituals. There are millions of them every day in every place. But nowadays, we have also to take account of the possibility of gods wandering from place to place without allotted temples or established rituals. So I love this bit too. We have wandering gods. I think it's Greek. Enai gar kai into utotheos. Here too are the gods to be found. These words of Heraclitus can today be given one further meaning, at least. It could also be that they now only have this meaning, according to which here can be without place, nowhere or from place, to place, a here wandering in and out of places. So I put Tathagata there as well. It could well be, this is all that can be said, that it is henceforth to a wandering of the gods that divine worship and its permanent locations must be adapted. Not so as to disqualify these, but so as to assert that in temples or outside of them, in rituals or with no ritual, what henceforth is divine, or that part of the divine that withdraws and confides itself, is a wandering, not to say a straying, a garment of the gods. There is no ritual of wandering, nor should the significance of divine service be overstretched so as to make it, with Hegel, the equivalent of reading one's daily paper, but in divine wandering, a ritual remains to be invented, or forgotten. We're gonna stop there. It's pretty close to an hour. So I appreciate you guys being here. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned some stuff and enjoyed meditating on the text with me. So take care. Come back soon if you're having a blast. And I'll keep putting stuff out. So we'll be camping soon. See ya.